We think of the technological revolution of our day with a lot of hindsight, I think. Presidents today, economic advisors, best-selling techno gurus all say we should unleash and get out of the way of the entrepreneurs out there who already apparently have the ideas that are going to save the economy and inaugurate a new era of prosperity. But back when the U.S. economy was mired in recession, back in 1975, when Steve Jobs and Bill Gates were playing with G.I. Joes and Legos, well, who knows, maybe they were just playing chess all the time. Back in the 70s, when the Dow Jones Industrial Average was trading at 570 rather than about 14,570 as it is today, nobody was talking about the entrepreneurs out there in garages who are supposed to come save the economy.
America needs a new direction, which I have sought to chart here today. A change of course which will put the unemployed back to work, increase real income and production, restrain the growth of federal government spending, achieve energy independence, and advance the cause of world understanding.
Now, President Gerald Ford was on to something. He just didn't know what. There was a new direction for America around the corner in 1975. It just couldn't be predicted or imposed. Our next guest says, if we think we understand the implications of technology, can simply apply it to problems like glue and nails to fix a window or something, we may be deluding ourselves. Technology theorist and writer Evgeny Morozov is the author most recently of To Save Everything, Click Here. And he joins us. Welcome.
Good to be back.
So let's talk a little bit about the delusions of technology. It seems to me, in summary, your book is about we've gone well beyond the gadget era where some cool gee whiz object is going to change things. We're way beyond that in some place fundamentally different. Is that correct?
I would say yes. And we're beyond that for two reasons. One reason is that almost anything these days can have a sensor built into it, so it can be made smart. You have all sorts of smart devices, like smart shoes that know when they're about to get worn out because they have sensors built into them. So proliferation of sensors is one trend. Another trend is the fact that we all carry our smartphones also connected to the internet with us everywhere, which means that our friends essentially follow us anywhere we go. So those two trends, sensors on the one hand and proliferation of social networks into virtually everything, have made it possible to start solving problems in a new way. What I'm arguing in the book is that not everything that we now imagine as a problem is actually a problem worth solving. And just because we have the tools doesn't mean that we shouldn't necessarily embark on solving many of the problems that Silicon Valley wants to solve.
And it's not just Silicon Valley. It's Washington, D.C. talks this speak as much as anybody. One of the things you point out here in this book is that police love this proliferation of sensors and big data, and there's not a lot of consideration. But if you pour through the literature, you see, and you quote actually in your book, an LAPD official, Los Angeles Police Department official, praising Amazon back in 2009 for its ability to aggregate customer data and predict future activity. Sounds like he wants to arrest people before the commission of a crime.
Well, predictive policing is a technology that describes the strength and proliferation of what is known in the industry as big data. But here again, it's very important to start asking questions about the assumptions that we built into our predictive models. If some people are not reporting crimes for various reasons, then those crimes are not going to be reflected in our models. So when we predict future crimes, we're not likely to pay attention to whatever it is that is not reported in the past. Or the software that is built by private companies that then sell it to police departments, we don't examine that software. We don't know what kind of algorithms it relies on. We don't know what kind of biases, whether racial or economic biases, it might be incorporating. So in the book, I'm trying to understand what are some of the schemes through which we can introduce a little bit more transparency and accountability to such software, because essentially it does perform a very public function, but we have very little control over it, just like we have very little control over Google search algorithms.
Is part of this that if you look into the discourse on technology in the United States, everybody seems to be technologically neutral, and that if you look at the literature, there's almost no critique of the implications of technology. It's as though we assume by a ratio of 1,000 to 1 that all technological developments are necessarily good unless they're proved false.
Well, I think for a very long time, our debate about technology has been dominated by two camps that I think have outlived their usefulness. And one camp were people who hated technology, the technophobes, and another camp was people who loved technology, the technophiles, and there was very little in between. In part because both camps started with this assumption that technology is something that is very coherent. Technology is like science, or technology is like religion, and they operated with this notion of technology with a capital T. And I think it's very important that we move beyond that notion, that we start interrogating technologies in the plural, because all of them have their different logics. Some of them do improve efficiency, but many of them don't. Some of them do enslave us, but many of them liberate us.
To be an engineer is not enough to be an engineer. You quote a Spanish author in your book. What does that mean?
Very often engineers are being asked to take on questions and problems that have public relevance, that have relevance for politics, that have relevance for our social institutions. For example, now there is a lot of excitement about online education. But obviously, if you know nothing about education, if you don't know what are some of the values driving it, what is the value of a good teacher, what is the value of a good pedagogue, chances are you wouldn't find a good way to improve it because you start from very erroneous set of assumptions. So as engineers in Silicon Valley and developers are being asked to take on this very important public missions and public projects, it's important that they also draw on humanities, that they also draw on what we know about politics, that they also draw on what we know about education. Because unless they build those bridges to the outside world they're trying to improve, they will end up producing technologies that are either going to make things worse or just not likely to take off to begin with.
Is that like the difference between the technology that gives us cars that can go 150 miles an hour because we're able to do it versus the technology that gives us airbags, which is something we actually need as a consequence to the first technology?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would definitely help, and a lot of technology companies already do that, is for them to reach out to anthropologists and to reach out to ethnographers who can actually go and study technologies in use. When it comes to improving politics, for example, in America, you have all sorts of civic startups that also try to bypass the party system and allow people to completely go beyond representative democracy and start acting together, bypassing traditional institutions. And all of those sound very exciting on paper, but if you start thinking about the implications of such projects, if from the perspective of political theory or what we know about from political philosophy, all of them look very naive and some look outright dangerous. And you cannot improve politics without building those bridges to people who actually know something about democracy, who know something about politics. And this is where I think dialogue is crucial. Otherwise, we'll end up with lots of fixes to problems that do not exist or exist in a way that is not obvious to Silicon Valley.
Evgeny Morozov, thanks so much for being with us. And it's safe for you to turn your smartphone back on now, I think.
All right. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.